We'll bring the Mining and Outdoor Recreation Committee to order. Representative Luick, you've had a chance to look at the minutes.
I would move the minutes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Luick. Representative Luick moves the minutes. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Members, today we are going to have the legislative auditor do a presentation, and we'll ask him to come up at this time. We're going to hear a report on the mineral taxation evaluation that the legislative auditor did. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jim Nobles. I'm the legislative auditor, and with me at the table is Jody Hauer, who was the manager of this evaluation. And thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I know you're very busy, and we appreciate you taking time to have us release and present this report to you today. This is a topic that we were asked last year to evaluate. You know, we just went through our most recent topic selection process. We do that every year. And last year, legislators asked us to look at mineral taxation. Now, when we went around and asked many of you, why do you want us to look at mineral taxation? I think many of you, with the exception of Iron Range legislators, said, we just don't understand how mineral taxation works. We would just like a basic primer on how it works. It comes before our committees. We'd just like to be better informed. We understand, of course, that legislators like Representative Van Zels understands this very well, and he can probably also do a very good job of educating members about how it works. But we hope that this report will just be a good primer for you over the years, for this committee and other committees as you delve into these various issues. Of course, as long as we were doing an evaluation, we also wanted to look for areas where we thought improvements could be made, whether just in updating statutes or clarifying. So with that, Mr. Chair and members, I'd like to turn to Jody Hauer to make a brief presentation of our report. And thanks again, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Jody Hauer, and for the record, I'm with the Office of the Legislative Auditor. As Jim Noble suggested, we had really two charges with this particular evaluation. One was to just describe what does the mineral taxation system consist of. And that was, in part, just what are the tax rates, what is the tax base, how is it structured, and it's also, in part, how are the revenues distributed. Our second charge was to look more at how well the distribution works and how well the system works, in addition to looking at whether or not the oversight in the system is sufficient. So I'm going to get into some of those details in this presentation. Before I do, though, I want to acknowledge my coworker, Laura Logston, who's here in the audience, who worked with me on this evaluation. So I'm going to start with just a brief introduction to, okay, what is mineral taxation? And in Minnesota, we have a set of taxes that applies exclusively to mining operations. But that set of taxes differs somewhat by the type of material that's being mined, and I'm going to briefly describe that here. Minnesota's largest mining operations obviously are those of mining taconite, which taconite, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, it's a rock with a low content of iron in it, and it's mined, it's deposited in and mined only in northeastern Minnesota. Statutes have actually a set of 12 different taxes that apply to the mining of taconite. But the one that generates the most revenue, and that'll be the subject of our discussion today, is the production tax. In 2014, the production tax raised nearly $110 million, and those dollars get distributed to local jurisdictions and other entities up on the Iron Range. The production tax is paid by mining companies in lieu of a property tax on their active mining areas and plants and facilities. The second significant tax for mining ore is the occupation tax. This is imposed on, it's imposed in lieu of the corporate franchise tax. So mining companies have this occupation tax that is paid instead of corporate income tax. But it generated less in revenue than does the taconite production tax. And in 2014, it was $15.8 million generated by that occupation tax. Now that tax also is a little bit different in that the revenues go into the state's general fund primarily for statewide purposes. Switching gears here a little bit, we'll look next at aggregates. It's also an industry, of course, in Minnesota that involves mining. Aggregates are things like sand, gravel, granite, and the like. And in statutes, four different types of taxes apply to mining the aggregates. The aggregate producers do also pay a production tax, but it's quite different in nature than the production tax that the taconite producers have to pay. It's far less substantial, for one thing. And the aggregate producers are not exempt from paying the property tax on their active mining areas and plants, as the taconite producers are. Then the next set of materials are non-ferrous minerals. These are the minerals other than iron ore, things like copper, nickel, palladium, platinum, and the like. And in Minnesota statutes, six different types of taxes apply to the non-ferrous minerals. Now, of course, mining hasn't yet begun, although, as you're all well aware, exploration is underway in northeastern Minnesota and elsewhere on for some of these particular minerals. So if mining should commence in Minnesota, then the primary tax that the mining companies would pay would be a net proceeds tax. And right now, current law has that at 2% of a 2% net proceeds tax. Those mining companies would also be subject to the occupation tax that the taconite producers currently pay. Now, in the written report, I believe all of you have that. In this written report, we go into quite a bit more detail on the different taxes that apply to these different types. But for today's presentation, I'm going to focus on the iron ore mining, and in particular on the production tax, which is the one that generates the most revenue. So to get us started on that, take a look here at this map, which gives us some orientation to where the mining occurs. If you look at that small inset map, sort of in the lower right corner, that gives you the idea of where in the state we'll be discussing today. Then the larger map shows what the location is of the taconite mining operations as of last year, 2014. In that year, five mining companies were operating with nine different operating areas, including mines and plants. You can see that from this map, most of those were located in St. Louis County, but a few were in Itasca County and one in Lake County. I'm going to provide an overview of the major findings that we concluded as a result of our research, and then I want to get into a bit of detail on each of them. Our first finding is that the production tax revenue is allocated to 27 different accounts, but some of those accounts enjoy certain benefits that the others do not, and it's not entirely clear why, and I'll get more into that in just a moment. The second finding is that the production tax revenue distributed to local jurisdiction in the Iron Range area lacks predictability as you look at it from one year to the next. Third finding, legislators have made some one-time grants of production tax revenue that came out of a certain account to local jurisdictions, but the process that was followed did not meet some of the criteria and best practices that are in place for managing state grants. Fourth, two of the major funds that receive production tax revenue have unclear or unspecified purposes. And then finally, the statutes that authorize mining taxes can be very complex, and they lack transparency. Some of them contain numerous obsolete or outdated references. So let me get into a bit more detail, especially starting now with just to help you understand how the money that is generated by the production tax gets put into 27 different accounts, and then that money is allocated out to the intended recipients, the school districts, the counties, the cities and townships, and the IRRRB. So, as an example, of these 27 accounts, three of those accounts are then later distributed to counties. Each of them has a distribution formula that's in law, and each of the accounts actually is distributed somewhat differently from the others. So, for instance, one of these accounts that go then eventually to the counties is the County Road and Bridge Fund, which primarily last year went to St. Louis County, but also a little bit went to Itasca and a little bit went to Lake County. But the revenues from the other two accounts will go to some of those same counties, but not all of them, because the distribution formula varies by each of these accounts. For municipalities, the production tax revenue gets distributed first into seven accounts, and then that money is distributed out to municipalities around the Iron Range. Now, again, each of these seven accounts has its own allocation formula plus its own distribution formula. Let me give you just one example. One of those seven accounts is something that's called the Township Fund, and for that particular fund, the money that's in that and then gets distributed out to the 69 townships that are located in a certain area up on the Iron Range. Another one of those seven accounts actually gets distributed to just two entities, one city and one township. And each of those allocation formulas into the accounts and the distribution out is, each of those is in statute. For school districts, another seven accounts that then get distributed to one or more of the 15 school districts that are on the Iron Range. Another set, nine set of accounts get distributed to the Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation Board. Now, some amount, a very small amount of that actually goes to pay for the administrative expenses of the IRRRB, but most of that revenue goes to the IRRRB for use in economic development and other public works projects on the Iron Range. Three remaining accounts, one of those is a property tax relief account, and then the final two, that property tax relief account pays for the taconite homestead credits that certain properties are eligible for. And then the final two accounts are far smaller, but one of them is the Hockey Hall of Fame, which is located in Eveleth, Minnesota, and the second is the acronym RAMS, which stands for Range Area Municipalities and Schools. So those are the 27 accounts that receive revenue as of last year, as of what was in statute last year. Now, many of the formulas that distribute the money from those 27 accounts then has that revenue going out to eligible taxing jurisdictions that are located in what's called the taconite assistance area. And you see on this map, the green area depicts that taconite assistance area. At the same time, some of the revenue is instead distributed to just a subset of the taconite assistance area, and that subset is called the tax relief area. This area on the particular map that you have in front of you has got the light yellow shading. So again, let me refer to the township fund. That is one where the distribution formula in law has the money that goes into that account distributed out to the 69 townships that are located entirely within the area bounded by this yellow tax relief area. Now, statutes do define each of these two areas, and it's based on describing eligible school districts and the municipalities within those school districts. Moving on, each one of these 27 accounts has its own allocation formula in law, as I've already said, but a limited number of the accounts have certain benefits that don't apply to all of them. So that's what I want to describe next. First, of those 27 accounts, four of them receive allocations that increase each year according to the implicit price deflator changes from one year to the next. The implicit price deflator is a measure of inflation. So essentially, as inflation increases, the amount allocated into these four particular accounts also increase from one year to the next. The township fund is one of those four that is indexed to inflation. Another is the IRRRB indexed account. There's one called the Douglas Johnson Economic Protection Trust Fund that's also indexed to inflation. And then up until last year, the property tax relief account was also indexed to inflation. I want to give just an example of what that means in terms of practical understanding of what being indexed to inflation can mean. And for the township fund, in law, it's to get 3 cents per ton of the production taxes generated in a given year. But because this is one of those that's indexed to inflation, instead it actually gets 3.3 cents per ton every year. And the same would be true for the other three accounts that have been indexed to inflation. As we looked at these, it became clear to us that we didn't have a good understanding of why just these four had that benefit of being indexed to inflation when the other accounts did not. Now, similarly, 10 of the 27 accounts have what we call guaranteed amounts in the allocations that go out to them. And I'll try to explain that here briefly. The amounts that are guaranteed are based on what these 10 accounts received from production taxes that were paid back in 1983 and 1999. These are the years when both Butler Mining and LTV Steel Mining were still operating. So the allocations that are calculated today take amounts and attribute them to both Butler and LTV that were operating back in those years, 83 and 99, but obviously those companies aren't around anymore to pay those taxes. So instead, the amount that's attributable to those two companies is paid out of two of the funds that do receive production tax revenue and are overseen by the IRRRB. And those two funds are the Douglas Johnson Economic Protection Trust Fund and the Environmental Protection Fund. Again, statutes do not make it clear why these particular 10 accounts receive this guaranteed level of allocation. Now, we recommend that the legislature review whether this limited number of accounts that receive production taxes in terms of either the indexed allocation, indexed inflation, or in terms of the guaranteed allocation amounts still are accomplishing their intended purposes. Now, tied to that recommendation is another aspect of the tax itself, and this particular slide shows you in the yellow kind of dashed line, shows you how many tons of taconite was produced each year over the last 38 years. And you can see from that up and down high peaks, low valleys of that yellow dashed line that the nature of taconite mining can be very cyclic. Some years with high production, if you look at 2009 over on the right-hand side, that was certainly an extreme low point where really the production was just 17 million tons. Now, to smooth out sort of those high points and low valleys, the taxable tonnage of taconite is calculated exclusively on a three-year average of production. So each year, we'll look at what is the number of tons that is produced, and then that's averaged with the two prior years to come up with this three-year average of production that's actually taxable. The red solid line that you see on this particular slide shows what this taxable tonnage is, and you can see that it's a bit smoother than the year-by-year annual production of taconite. Now, the smoothing is very helpful to the local jurisdictions that get their revenue from the production tax. In low production years, they will get less than they would the prior year, but the amount that they get is not going to be as low as it would be if the tax were instead imposed on a single year of production. When we conducted this evaluation, we spoke with representatives from a number of local taxing jurisdictions up on the Iron Range, and every single one of them told us that they very much appreciated having this three-year averaging because it does help them in terms of the revenues from one year to the next. But at the same time, many of those that we interviewed said that the three-year average does not help them in terms of producing predictable revenues as they go from one year to the next. Some said that it was very difficult to set their budgets because they didn't know how much revenue to expect from the production tax. And even though that red line on the previous slide that showed taxable tonnage, it was smoother than the dashed line, but there still is a lot of variation in it. It's not what you'd call a straight line measure. And so what that really indicates is that there still is quite a bit of variability from year to year in the taxable tonnage, and that in turn affects the revenues that go to the local governments and school districts. Now, this can be particularly troublesome for those taxing jurisdictions that rely heavily on the production tax as a source of their local revenues. And we found that one in five of the Iron Range municipalities relied on direct and indirect production tax revenue for at least 20% of their budget. So you can imagine if they go from one year to the next with such a heavy concentration of reliance on production tax that not being able to know how much is coming in can be difficulty in terms of budgeting. We recommend that the legislature take some steps to make these allocations of the production tax more predictable than they are now. And this can be done in a number of ways, and we discuss a couple of them in our report, but the one that I'm going to focus on is a method that is based on the mechanisms that are used today in the current system. So in the option that we describe in our report, the legislature would set a new base year for the allocations into the 27 accounts or some portion of those 27 accounts. And then from that year forward, the amounts would be guaranteed at that level. So in years with high production or even average production, the amount of production tax generated would be sufficient to pay those guaranteed amounts. In low production years, though, there would be a need to supplement whatever tax was generated in that particular year to pay the guaranteed levels. So we, again, kind of mimicking what is in place already for the existing system, we suggest using those same sources, which are the Douglas Johnson Economic Protection Fund and the Environmental Protection Fund. Other sources, though, are also possible. We do, for instance, recommend that the legislature would reserve a small percentage of the production tax revenue in those years where there is high production, and then set that side amount, reserve it for use in future years when the production is low, so that those guaranteed amounts can still be paid, but it would be paid at least in part with the reserve that's set aside. This approach would reduce the volatility that's now in the system in terms of allocations from one year to the next. And it's even possible that the three-year averaging would no longer be needed. I'm going to move on now to the next topic. In six out of the last 8 years, legislators have made one-time grants to local governments, mostly with money that came from surplus that was left in the property tax relief account. Now, this account was set up originally to use production tax revenue to pay for the homestead credits of the residential homesteads and the agricultural homesteads that are up on in the tax relief area. Up through 2013, statutes had allocated to this account 33.9 cents per ton. But this was one of those four I mentioned earlier that had been tied to inflation. So because it was indexed with inflation, it actually in 2013 received 43.5 cents per ton in 2013. The account generated more revenue than what was needed to pay for those taconite homestead credits. And there's nothing in statute now that establishes or specifies how account surplus should be used or what kind of oversight there should be of that surplus. Legislators did use that money, much of it, to award grants to local communities. Many of those grants went to infrastructure projects, like storm sewer projects, upgrades of water systems, and the like. We looked at the process that was followed for awarding those grants, and we measured them against a set of criteria and best practices for managing state grants. We did find some issues that I'll describe now. We think that the process used lacked sufficient safeguards. For example, one criterion in managing state grants is to award those grants through a competitive application process. But for many of the grants that were awarded in these last 8 years, there was no application process. Another criterion is to have a written contract that will lay out what the expectations are of the grantee, of the person, the entity receiving the grant, but the grant agreements were not written for these particular grants. A third criterion is to have formal oversight of the grants. And this would include things like conducting site visits during the course of the project that's underway, that's being funded, reviewing progress reports on that project, and then when it comes to the end, formally closing it out and tying off the grant with a final report. But we found that oversight in these ways was lacking and insufficient. So we recommend two things related to the poverty tax relief account. The first is that the legislature should specify in law criteria that would outline, that would lay out the uses for the surplus of this account in years when a surplus is generated. The second recommendation is that the legislature establish a formal process for overseeing the one-time grants that go out to local jurisdictions from the surplus in this account. Now, one option here, again, this could be done any number of ways, but one option that we suggest looking at is using the IRRRB staff to manage some of these accounts once the grants have been made by the board. And of course, the board, I'm sure most, not all of you know, that the board is comprised entirely of legislators. They should continue to make those decisions about how much and where that grant would go, those grants would go. But we would see the staff then having a role in managing the application process, in writing the grant agreements, and then overseeing them as the projects proceed. The next fund I'm going to talk about is the Economic Development Fund. This fund was established in 1992. Right now, or as of last year, 25 cents per ton was allocated into this fund, but that allocation is held by the IRRRB in separate accounts for each one of the taconite producers, each one of the mining companies that had produced taconite the previous year. So the money may be used by companies for acquiring plant and equipment, stationary equipment, for mining, or for research and development in mining and production technology. But to receive the funding, the companies have to follow a prescribed process that's laid out in statutes. One of those steps that they have to follow is companies have to review their proposals before they come to the IRRB. They have to review those proposals with representatives of their non-salaried employees. They also have to provide matching grants to fund those projects. And they cannot spend that money on equipment other than stationary equipment. This means that they may not use that fund to pay for rolling stock, things like the ore haulage trucks or mining shovels. And the law now prohibits use of the fund for those types of items. One provision in the statute now allows the IRRB to deposit this Economic Development Fund's money into a separate account. It's called the Environmental Protection Fund. They can do that if they, in a given year, do not approve what companies' proposals are for the use of those dollars. We concluded that this somewhat muddies the purpose of the Economic Development Fund. I mean, from its beginning back in 1992, the fund had been used exclusively for company reinvestment proposals. But in 2007 and 2009, the legislature did pass legislation that added a sentence to the statute that requires the IRRB to set aside that anytime there is a proposal that the IRRB does not approve, then that money can be set aside instead into the Environmental Protection Fund and used for the purposes for which that fund was set up. The addition of that one sentence now allows the fund to be used for multiple purposes, even though all the remaining language in that statute pertains to the mining company's use of those funds for reinvestment purposes. Now, there was one year back in 2011 when the IRRB did just that. They did allocate half of the money to the Environmental Protection Fund, and the other half went to mining companies for their projects. Now, how this Taconite Economic Development Fund should be used is certainly a matter that belongs in the hands of the legislature to decide. And right now, as it stands, the legislature has made this fund one that has multiple purposes. And if the legislature continues to want to use this fund as a multiple purpose fund, certainly that's acceptable, but we think that in the interest of transparency, the statute should be amended to make it clear that it can be used for multiple purposes. On the other hand, if the legislature should decide that the fund should be used more along the lines of the original intent of the statute, which was to fund the mining company's proposals, then we would recommend that the legislature change the statute so that that provision that would have the money not used for mining company proposals instead be placed into the Environmental Protection Fund. We think that should go away. So either way is fine. We just think that for the sake of clarity, the legislature should take some steps to clarify what the intended use is of this particular fund. Our second recommendation is that the legislature would remove the prohibition that's now in law to use money from this Economic Development Fund for money on rolling stock, that is anything, mining equipment that's not stationary. The last major point that I'll discuss this morning is that we found some statutes that authorize the mineral taxation to be complex. They lack transparency. When we interviewed representatives of the local jurisdictions that benefit from this tax, we heard that most of them would characterize the system as something that was very complicated and difficult for them to fully understand. Many of them told us that they doubted that their citizens really had an inkling of how this production tax was generated, how it was allocated out, and then how it was distributed to the local jurisdictions. There's one chapter in law, Chapter 298, where the mineral tax is described and defined. But this chapter in law contains numerous outdated provisions. Some are obsolete. As one example, the Economic Development Fund we talked about a moment ago, that has many provisions in that chapter on the Economic Development Fund, but one of them describes the requirements for distributing the revenue from that fund as of 2008. That provision is no longer relevant, but it remains in statute. And there are several provisions like that. We think that these outdated provisions just add to the lack of clarity for understanding the system. The law contains formulas to calculate the allocations into those 27 accounts I mentioned at the outset. The law also contains formulas for the distribution of the money out of those accounts to the intended recipients. And several of those formulas are quite complex. They involve multiple layers of calculations. We're not suggesting that that has to change. It's just one of the factors that adds to the complexity of the system and the difficulty in understanding it. During our evaluation, we found one error that's in statute, and we found several errors in the Department of Revenue's Mining Tax Guide. The tax guide is an annual publication that the department issues. It's the department's attempt to describe how the mineral taxation system works, even given the complicated statutes, but by using non-technical language. Some of the errors that we identified were in just a single edition of that tax guide. Others actually occurred in multiple editions of the guide. Beyond that, we spent a little time looking at the calculations that were made last year for the distributions that occurred in 2014. And we found two relatively minor errors when we looked through those calculations. The errors affected just two of the accounts, and they resulted in a relatively small but incorrect allocation to one of the accounts that had occurred back in the late 1990s over a three-year period. So regarding the complexity issue, we have two recommendations. The first is that the legislature should ensure that these outdated mineral taxation provisions are deleted and that any erroneous statutes get corrected. Using that one sentence makes it sound like it's a simple endeavor. We understand it is not. We know it's more than a simple undertaking, but we think it would be a good first step to help improve people's understanding of what the tax system consists of. And of course, it would be the logical place for that work to occur would be in the revisor's office. And we think that the legislature should authorize that work for the Office of the Revisor of Statutes. The second recommendation is that the Department of Revenue maintain accurate and historical information on mineral taxation. It's important that the information be broadly available to many, many users and that it can be corrected in real time so that when errors occur or when changes occur, as they frequently do, they can be made and editions of the past guide can be corrected if need be. And the department is planning some changes even this year that will address some of these issues. So, Mr. Chair, with that, I will conclude my remarks. I do want to point out that our full report contains more information than what I've described here today. It does include some detailed information on each of those 27 accounts, both how the money goes into those accounts and how it gets distributed out. We talk also about some of the region-wide distribution patterns of the production tax revenue. But with that, I'll conclude my remarks for now and would be glad to answer questions.
Thank you, Ms. Howard. Members, Representative Considine, question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually wanted to get into this question prior to your going into northern Minnesota. I'm from southern Minnesota, and I have a question about aggregate. In southern Minnesota, a number of companies mine silica sand, which when they were doing it for glass-making purposes, they were getting about $30 a ton. Now that they're calling it fracking sand, they're getting $300 a ton. And I'm wondering how that affects the tax structure for those operations.
Sauer?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the production tax for the aggregates is a 15 cent per ton production tax. So the price that the sand is sold in the market for really doesn't affect that rate. That's something that's set and used then by county or by each of the townships. There are a handful of townships that also have authority to impose that tax. So the value of the sand on the market is not reflected in the production tax that's paid.
Thank you. Sounds like there's some updating we could do there then, too. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Methlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess I just wanted to point out one thing that I thought might have jumped out for members, and that's the rolling stock and why we don't fund that. And we might disagree with Mr. Pagel here from the Iron Mining Association. He's shaking his head no. Essentially, what rolling stock investment would be the trucks we're talking about. The reason we haven't historically done that is in a shutdown, the first thing to get sold off is the equipment. And so what we would be looking to do is protect the taxpayer investment by having an actual building or something there, because in state statute as well, the companies are required to keep the facilities in operating condition, just like LTV, which actually gave us PolyMet's site. And the only reason PolyMet can go in there is because of this legislation, which Representative Rukavina, I believe, carried. I don't know when that was. But that was done in the early 2000s, and so I just wanted to put that on public record that I think, in my opinion, will continue. I would disagree with the legislative auditor's office on it and say that it would be a bad investment to give it to the company. If the company were going to turn around and sell it, we don't know what a future market brings, and so our investments in their return, we'd prefer to keep in very physical things that would be very hard to move.
Mr. Chair, Representative Metza and others, let me just give you two pieces of background about what led us to that particular recommendation. We did interview representatives of three of the mining companies, and we interviewed also representatives of three of the union locals up there, specifically about the Economic Development Fund. And each of those two groups gave us ideas of projects that they would have liked to have funded in part with the Economic Development Fund money, but that they couldn't fund because of this prohibition. And then beyond that, there is a provision in the statute that says for any funds that would have been used out of this Economic Development Fund and then used to pay for rolling stock, the company would have been required to pay back some amount of it if it does eventually get moved out of the state. And that was put into place for 2007, and it actually goes through a window through 2017 over a 10-year period. And we checked to see how many projects were required to pay back, and it turns out that none of them, there were none. So there weren't any funds used for that purpose for purchasing items that then were transported away from the Iron Range. So that's what led us to our conclusion that the use of this money could perhaps be used also for rolling stock in addition to the plant facilities.
Thank you, Ms. Hart. Representative Metza, follow up?
Unless there's member questions, don't they?
Representative Angel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to state clearly that I see the evaluation that you've done as being very worthwhile. Certainly it has merit, and certainly your findings should be dealt with by the legislature. I do, however, find a couple of shortcomings, glaring omissions. One is the definition of a ton. It is the long ton definition that is used to compute the production tax, which one can easily conclude means that the mining companies are assessed at 2,240 pounds as the definition of a ton rather than 2,000. And so the argument can be made that the state has undervalued the amount of the ton, and therefore the tax collected per ton is short. Secondly, I believe your analysis of the taconite fund for producer grants was well done, but you failed to clearly state that this fund is a rebate off the production tax. The production tax is $2.56 a long ton, and by 25 cents a long ton, the companies can get this money back. I think that is something that needs further discussion. And half of the 25 cents requires a match by the companies dollar for dollar. And as far as the rolling stock issue is concerned, that is in statute to prevent a mining company from getting a break on their taxes to upgrade, maintain, and equip rolling stock, only to find years later that that rolling stock is used in a mining operation in Canada or Australia or some other country. That was the intent of that. Lastly, Mr. Chair, and thank you for indulging me here, most, if not all, of the complexity in mining production taxes began to occur after the year 1985, because it was in the year 1985 that the iron mining industry on the Mesabi began its steady decline. And the legislature looked at the decline and saw that the 15 school districts in the taconite relief area had lost and were losing through those years up to today 25,000 students. There are 25,000 less students, K-12, in those 15 school districts. And the taconite relief area, the map that you saw, the population of that area has declined by one-third over the last three censuses. And so the legislature, in an attempt to stop the bleeding, in an attempt to keep the region vibrant and alive, to keep the region potentially an area where the diversification of that economy could occur, the legislature made a whole bunch of statutory changes, and all were designed to prevent a problem. All were designed in one way or another to prevent and slow down the decline of the area. Lastly, I believe that it was those attempts by the legislature, some of which worked and some of the things that the legislature did not work, and the decline continues. And certainly it behooves legislatures to come to address these matters that you have identified here, but it will be hard. Seeing a natural resource area dominated area like the Mesabi decline as it has is very, very difficult. But I want to thank you for doing a good job.
Thank you, Representative Anzella. To that point, Representative Metz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, we appreciate the hard work done over the last year. I think it's a very thorough examination. And I thought of one other real quick thing that might have jumped out at people in the presentation, which was the property tax spend down. And I guess when I had partook in my first 2 years here in doing that through the Jobs Committee, which has jurisdiction over that, and I didn't realize that the agency didn't follow the same format for the grants that were given out in terms of the oversight, and that is something that we'll definitely correct moving forward. So I think that's an easy fix and a good suggestion.
Thank you. Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have a few questions, and I think maybe Representative Anzil may have answered some of them, but my curiosity was piqued also by the Taconite Economic Development Fund. And as I looked at the flowchart, and if I'm understanding this correctly, the segregation of the occupation tax and the production tax, the occupation tax being the equivalent of an income tax on the mining operation. The production tax, I guess I kind of think of it like as a depletion tax, but I guess I wanted to be clear that this money that is coming into the development fund, I thought it kind of a peculiar thing that money that's coming out of the operation is then coming back to the company in terms of these acquisitions, but I guess if it is the depletion tax component of it and that the purpose of the fund is to develop more production, that's the justification for that financial assistance. So is that correct?
Howard?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it certainly can be used in that way, but the law does not restrict it to that function. As I mentioned, actually the law permits use of it for research and development into new technologies. Many of the projects that have been funded by the Economic Development Fund have been things like updating certain areas where updating a tool shop within the area where the miners are working, providing some things that maybe wouldn't have been done otherwise. We thought there was a lot of value in the Taconite Economic Development Fund based on the interviews we conducted. The union officials, for instance, were very emphatic that they thought that there were many projects that benefited their members and added to the longevity of the plant because of the Economic Development Fund funding. However, it's not restricted to just what, as in your terms, you call it depletion-type funding. And so, yes, it can be used that way, but it's not necessarily restricted to that.
Does that hurt us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think the difficulty I have with that is a little bit to what Representative Anzil led into, is the idea that in real estate, for example, one of the principles we learn is on the basis of an individual, it's very difficult to overcome economic obsolescence. Only government or entities that have the power of levy or huge resources can overcome urban blight. You know, an individual, it's very difficult to do that, but government can maybe do it. And what I've heard here is 30 years of intervention, even on the part of government, is showing that to overcome that decline in an industry or the obsolescence isn't working. And so that in a certain way, that intervention might have enabled things to continue without the influence of the market really making those changes in an area, whether you transition to recreation economy or other types of diverse parts of it. The other question I wanted to ask was on one of the slides here. It mentioned that 1 in 5 municipalities receive a production tax revenue, and I'm not clear from the graphic if 1 in 5 municipalities receive this production tax revenue. Was that in the form of property tax relief? And if it's 1 in 5, approximately how many communities then really did receive this production tax credit that was at that 20% threshold?
Sorry.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hertaus, actually what I meant there is that one in five of the 180-plus municipalities on the Iron Range use revenues from the production PACs, either that comes to them directly from one of those 27 accounts I described, or that comes indirectly through the IRRRB. So perhaps they had a project that was funded in part by IRRRB funding. So the Department of Revenue had put together a study looking at these different revenue sources, and it showed that for these one in five communities, these communities relied on those indirect and direct sources of the production tax for at least 20% of their budget. And there were a handful, I can't remember, it was about 15 communities that relied on production tax revenues for over half of their revenue.
Okay. So if there's 180 communities, 20% of that would be 36 or so communities are at that threshold of being 20% of their revenues or higher. So that would be correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes. So it's about 20% of that 180, it's 189 to be precise, okay. Communities.
And then lastly, I guess I would...
That hurt us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then I would be interested to kind of figure out if these communities are also receiving local government aid in addition to this production tax, and if, in fact, their revenues are maybe 50 or 70 or 80%, dependent upon outside revenue.
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, indeed, these communities, like any other community in the state, can be eligible for local government aid, and they can rely very heavily on local government aid, and that, of course, will vary from one community to the next, but yes, indeed, that is a part of their revenue sources. And that was they also do obviously get property tax revenue from their non-mining entities, their residential property, any other commercial property that's not mining property. So they do have multiple sources of revenue, and this comparison was to look at all those various sources of property-related type revenue and see how much did the production tax represent of that total.
That's an area that I'd like to learn more about.
Representative Mitzel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hertas, I just wanted to kind of clarify a couple things here. The production tax is in lieu of the property taxes. So, in fact, we see it, and our community members, I believe, see it as LGA when they're going through the formulas that are distributed that she was referencing for the disbursements on the specific accounts. So if it was the cities and townships accounts or the county account, it would be in lieu of those property taxes versus the companies paying the property tax directly and going to the county, which is typical everywhere else. It's collected through the agency and then dispersed that way, with the intent of that historically was to help the companies when times are like they are today, not have that big burden of the property tax everywhere, and have a little bit more of a predictable form, paying a little more when times are good and a little less when times aren't. And so we think it's been effective, by all means not perfect, but governing isn't perfect, so we're willing to continue working on making them better.
Senator Hertas.
Thank you, Representative Metzen, Chair. Well, I understood that part of it, that the companies aren't paying property tax, but the other members of the community are. They're paying property tax on their small business. They're paying property taxes on their home. So those types of entities in which most municipalities derive their revenue is from the local property tax. And since we've had this vigorous debate in property tax committee and about the fairness and the equity of it, and the formula which has been chided and derided and, you know, given different points of view, I certainly come to the table in property tax with the notion that there are 82 communities that are ignored. And so I would be of interest to find out that there's 180 cities in the Arrowhead that are receiving, in addition to local government aid, also receiving aid in the form of this revenue that is coming from production tax.
Representative Anzo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The decision to tax production rather than to attempt to assess value, was a momentous decision and a very good one. As you know, it would be impossible to assess the value of a mineral until it's mined, until it's sold, until it is affected by market conditions. That's why the decision to go to a tax on production was made. And that tax on production replaces the tax that the company would pay if it were required to pay a tax on the assessed value of its operation. It's really quite simple. You would get no argument from anyone on the Iron Range, I'm sure, that property taxes don't work very well for them, both residential and commercial. But this production tax, based on a 3-year average, is literally what has kept the communities in the taconite relief area viable. Were it not for this system, the taconite relief area would look much worse.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a number of questions. I'll just try and whip through them fairly quick, if that's okay. And they may be for the Department of Revenue, I think, may still be coming forward. Ms. Howard, did anybody do a study as to how these taxes that are paid compare to the rest of the state if they were paid as traditional tax? I mean, is this part of the state taxed more heavily than other parts of the state when it's used this protection type of tax instead of a value tax?
Howard.
Mr. Chair and Representative McNamara, do you mean how much revenue might be generated if the mining companies paid a property tax instead of the production tax? Is that what you're referring
yes.
to? Mr. Chair and Representative McNamara, no, because of the difficulty of determining what the value is of a mine. Unlike assessors obviously are charged with determining what the assessed value is of a building or land, a parcel, but economists kind of agreed decades ago that difficulty in assessing what the extent of the deposit is, what the value is there, what would be needed to extract the deposit, all contributed to, and other unknowns, all contributed to the difficulty in arriving at an accurate assessment of the value that against which a tax rate could be applied. So that's somewhat of a convoluted answer to your question, but it really turns out to be something that is just so very difficult to assess, unlike a building or unlike a home, that the severance tax has been commonly used instead of a property tax, not just in Minnesota, but in many other states that also have deposits of whatever, whether it's going to be gold or silver or some other kind of non-ferrous mineral.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Howard, then I guess my next question I'd like to ask. So in a downturn, we use the Doug Johnson Fund to backfill some of the underpayment because of the 3-year fluctuation. And then what are the implications? There's been rumors about people wanting to grab this fund and move it outside to where it can't be used. Would it still be used in this use, or what are the implications there? Would these communities not get the money, or what would happen?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative McNamara, by law, yes, that Douglas Johnson Economic Protection Fund is used to pay for the current set of guaranteed allocations. So unless that law were changed, it seems to me that it would still be required to pay for that, to backfill the amounts needed to arrive at that guaranteed level of allocation, unless the law changed. But given existing law, it seems it would still have to meet those obligations.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think at least two more if I could ask real quick. So I'm trying to understand. So we have this $2.56 long ton tax, but so we tax the companies at a higher level and then give part of them back. It seems like we have a lot of government involvement here in layers, and then we really politicize actually a company's capital equipment investments get caught up in the political process. And is this I'm trying to understand the logic of it, and it seems rather unique. Do we have other examples of where we do that in state government?
Ms. Howard?
Mr. Chair and Representative McNamara, I don't know of other examples, but I also haven't thought about it. I haven't tried to investigate whether there are other examples. But clearly this is an example of having the mining companies pay a certain amount per ton and then reserving a certain amount of that revenue for a specific purpose. In this case, the purpose is to have the mining companies invest, make some investments that they perhaps might not otherwise have made. Now, they are required, as of last year, actually the match is now 100% match. So they come forth with their proposals. If they are, those proposals are approved, the companies now are required to put up 100% match for that money. But you're right, Representative McNamara, in terms of it is taxing the companies and then reserving a portion of it for that particular purpose.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just point out, too, as all of you know, the legislature frequently considers proposals to give tax, what commonly would be called tax breaks, to certain companies for certain kinds of investments, particularly capital investments, exempting companies from sales tax, building certain facilities. So I don't think maybe this approach in and of itself is unique. But the idea of the legislature using the tax structure to advantage certain companies is not.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I get that, but it seems kind of unique that you take people's money away, the company's money away from them, and then say, well, we'll give you a little bit of it back, but we're going to lay out some criteria for how you should invest in your own company. It just is kind of unique. The other one I wouldn't mind touching on, did you get into the structure at all of the IRRRB and how it works in current law and the logic behind or illogic behind it?
Ms. Howard?
Mr. Chair and Representative McNamara, only to a limited degree, because we had to understand how the IRRRB works just because it receives quite a bit of the production tax revenue. But I would point out that in this most recent round of evaluations that the Legislative Audit Commission has directed our office to undertake in the coming interim, one of those topics is the IRRRB. And so actually I and my colleague Laura Logston and one other staff in our office will be evaluating the IRRRB itself. And there we'll look in quite a bit more depth into how that money has been used over the years. So for this study, we looked at it just to get a good understanding of what it was, how much revenue went to them, how it was used, but we really didn't look at it in depth, and that will be a part of this upcoming evaluation in the coming months.
Very good. Representative Mezza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative McNamara, I guess from my take that in your third question about the TDF disbursements and kind of what I heard is it worth it? And to us, right now, we have companies that, even within just the domestic United States, may choose to invest in Michigan. We use this to make sure that we can put something out that puts a carrot out there to invest in Minnesota. Cleveland Cliffs, over the last few years, as an example, has shut down a lot of its operations up in Canada, which were paid through a lot of the, I guess, profits made from the Minnesota operations, which were their most profitable mines in the country, and they were using that to invest elsewhere. This is our way of getting them to invest back here to create jobs and revenue, whether it be through the school trust fund, income tax, or other things, and have a little bit more stake in them bringing what they're making here in terms of income and putting a little of it back so we can retain that as long as we can.
Members, we need to adjourn in about 10 minutes to get to session by 1 o'clock, and we've got a few more people that have questions. We also want to bring up the Department of Revenue and answer any questions that they might have. So with that, please keep all that in mind. Representative Hertog.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so if I'm clear on the production tax component of it, most property taxpayers look at their property tax bill and look at land as a valuation, and then they look at the building or improvements. So what I'm, to be clear that I'm understanding this correctly, then the mining operation, the crushing mills, the facilities, all that stuff doesn't get taxed. It's just the production tax, so the amount of extraction that comes out of it. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hertaz, essentially, yes. All of the active facilities, the active mines, are what the production tax is assessed against. And there are, though, some minor property taxes for auxiliary mining lands that are not part of the active production, that where the property tax is still assessed. And there are, actually, we explain in our Chapter 1, those other areas where they actually do have to pay property taxes. But for the bulk of it, I mean, those are relatively small. The bulk of the tax that they're paying is going to be through that production tax, and then to a smaller extent, the occupation tax.
Thank you.
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I'm understanding this correctly, then this is a tremendous break for the mining companies. They don't have to pay what the value of the land is. On years when their production is down, they don't pay as much. It's tied to the production. So this is actually a really pretty good deal for them. I understand about the evaluation and things, but the gentleman back there, I see you're laughing. Is that not correct?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative, I would point out that in addition to the taxes, that mining companies pay royalties for any use of state land where they might be operating. Now, the royalty is not a tax, so it's different. We do address it. We describe it in the report. But it's not just the tax. It's also the royalties. And so there's a set of payments that they're making for public services that other non-mining industries are not paying. Excuse me. So whether or not it's a good deal, I guess, is in the eye of the beholder.
And Mr. Chairman, I would just also add to that, and then I think we will be gone and let the Department of Revenue. Whenever you're considering whether or not something is a good deal or not, it's in comparison to what? And again, I think the difficulty of doing the valuation of the property in the more traditional way, it gives you some kind of a blank to measure it against, because you don't know what that is. So again, is it a good deal or not? It is in the eye of the beholder, but since we don't have anything to compare it to, it's a hard judgment to make.
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you could spend an entire career just trying to understand this.
Well,
thank you.
Mr. Nobles and Ms. Howard, thank you very much for the report. You did a great job, and I want to thank you for bringing this forward to this committee so that we can make the announcement. I think members of the committee have a much better understanding of mineral taxes at this point, and look forward with working with the delegation from the Iron Range to maybe make some changes legislatively if we need to. So thank you for that. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jenny Starr. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Business Taxes at the Department of Revenue. And I want to, on behalf of Commissioner Bowerly, thank you so much for having us here today to be a part of today's hearing. We also want to thank the Legislative Auditor's Office, especially for the professionalism and courtesy that the office extended to Department of Revenue employees throughout the past year as this program evaluation has been ongoing. With regard to the recommendation regarding the Department of Revenue, we certainly welcome the review and appreciate the ongoing process to improve our part of administering Minnesota's tax laws. As you may know, the Department of Revenue first published our mining tax guide in 1978. And as you can see pictured here, it was a different time than it is today. But even then, that guide was known to provide our customers with easy-to-understand explanations of our laws and the types of tables, charts, and graphs that folks relied on for a historical understanding of these tax laws. This is the guide today. We've been publishing it annually since 1982. Today we have about 84 recipients on our distribution list for this printed guide. We also post this guide on our website in PDF form. I just checked this morning and noted that the PDF guide has been accessed over 160 times in the past 4 months that this particular 2014 guide has been online, which just tells us that there's absolutely a trend here in today's world of technology and information sharing that folks are very much interested in having access to this kind of information and a web-based content. So we have been undergoing a plan to get more of the mining guide information onto our website and to enhance the information that's available there. This summer, we're looking forward. We have plans to put some of our tables, charts, and graphs on the web in hopes that the digital format might provide opportunity to sort data, sortable tables, graphs that are easy to print. And as the legislative auditor recommends, this will also then become a place that when data changes, we can do that quickly and online, and folks won't have to wait for the annual printing of the guide to receive that kind of information. As I said, we anticipate our customers will start seeing this enhanced web content this summer. We have started an email group for folks who are interested in keeping up to date with us. To date, almost 300 people have signed up, so again, good evidence that people would like this information online and easy to access. All you need to do, if you're interested, is go to our website, type mining into the search box, put your preferred email address in, and we'll keep in touch with you as we update our content.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Questions, members? Representative Metzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I felt it prudent to give a shout-out to one of my constituents who works at the Department of Revenue, Bob Wagstrom, up in our Eveleth office, who I think both the companies, the legislators, and the department probably all wish he had probably a $2 or $3 million balloon policy on him. And he was sick recently this year, and I just wanted to, you know, say that he does such good work up there for the department. I think it's prudent to get someone else in. I know he's getting close to that age where you're thinking about retirement, and get someone who can get trained in and learn so we can have a kind of a seamless transition. So thanks for all that. And thank you, Bob, if you are watching.
Any other questions, members? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you,
committee. I think we're going to have to get to session soon, so meeting is adjourned. Thank you.